San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, buddy. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from KFMB Studios with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, down to Cabo, out to the desert. You can get us we stream live on 760KFMB.com, and also if you download the app for 760KFMB, you can hear us there on any device. And of course, all the podcasts are commercial-free on iymoney.com next week. So now, time to introduce the main man of the hour. He is an accomplished CPA, and he is a marathon runner. He is a best-selling author and a family office expert advising several high-net-worth families. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm marvelous, and I want to wish my mom a happy, I'm not going to say how many years, birthday. Her birthday sort of split the two Saturday shows, so I didn't know if I should do it last week or this week, so I saved it until this week. So happy birthday, Mom.
Yeah, she's a fan of the show, isn't she?
She's a big fan of the show.
Yeah, well, if your mom doesn't listen, we're in trouble.
I was going to say, my mom doesn't listen.
Because you never listened either, so.
I never listened to our show.
No, I mean to your mother.
Oh, to my mother.
Anyway.
And she never listens to me,
no,
so it's even.
I'm kidding. But look, last Saturday, there was a great concert. I don't know if you've been to the MCRD lately, but they invited, open to the public, they do it once a year. The Marine Corps Band had their annual winter holiday concert.
They're good.
Concert. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they're good.
Really, really phenomenal. But down both aisles on the sides were with all the recruits, and man, they just sat there like robots. They couldn't even applaud or anything, and I guess they were under orders just to sit there. But anyway, the band was great, and they had a guy come out and do an Elvis with an Elvis costume, and I think I'm going to get the recording of that, and we'll use it for bumper music for our Christmas show next Saturday. So that'll be kind of cool. So
that'll be fun.
Yeah.
So Joe, what's going on with your Padres?
The Padres. What do you mean the Padres?
Yeah, they've been trading for all these All-Stars.
Oh, look, you're the guy that follows baseball, not me. So
Matt Kemp, Justin Upton, Will Myers.
Did he pass his physical? I don't even know.
He has arthritis in both hips, but we took him anyway. We took him anyway because he's only 30. He's got 3 or 4 years left.
Honest to gosh, we took with arthritis. Oh my gosh. Anyway,
I'm sure a lot of elite athletes have arthritis in both hips.
Just like the Padres, you know. So anyway, well, let's hope they have an exciting year because our friend Dick Edberg loves the Padres.
And big congratulations to Dick because, you know, he made the Baseball Hall of Fame as an announcer, but also our good friend Jim Lampley.
Well, he's been in the Hall of Fame. This Frick Award is something additional because he's already in the Baseball Hall of Fame, but the Frick Award, I think, is something additional.
But our good friend Jim Lampley just made the Boxing Hall of Fame as an announcer.
Yeah, that was a big deal. And so congrats to both of them. And speaking of which, a lot of people don't know this, but Dick is also a playwright, and he wrote a play on if you follow basketball at all, the very noted basketball coach Al McGuire at Marquette. And it's already played at the North Coast Repertory Theater, I guess a few years ago.
It was a few years ago.
They're going to reprise it again in February 9th and 10th, and he said he'll come on the show and we could.
At North Coast Rep?
Correct.
Oh, cool, by my house.
Yeah, so.
I'll run over.
We'll get all the information out there.
We're going to attend.
Yes, absolutely.
Nice.
So
I love Al McGuire.
Yes.
And Dick Enberg.
Apparently it's a good play, and Bill Walton gives it very high marks, and I think he's already seen it, and he and his wife are going to go again, so it must be good.
Okay.
So,
but we're not going to have Bill on the show because we'd never get a word in if we did.
Who, Bill Walton?
Yeah, if we had him on the show, we wouldn't even be
able to
ask
questions.
He's
going to come on. He said he'll do it this year.
Okay.
Well, next year, 2015. So
okay.
We'll get him on. He'll have to bring his own chair. He brings that, his own chair.
Yeah, he brings his own chair.
You know, because he's a big guy.
That'll be cool, though. North Coast Rep for McGuire.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be exciting. So
she said February 9th and
10th? 9th and 10th.
Okay.
We'll get all the info. So we've been emailing each other this weekend, and I said we'll help any way we can. So
good.
He's grateful for that, and we're grateful for him.
Good.
Now, speaking of esteemed guests, boy, tonight we have somebody really terrific.
We always have somebody really terrific.
He's just
more terrificker.
Yeah. Well, wait till you hear this guy's credentials. I mean, he's if you've heard of the Enron case, he was one of 30 attorneys here. And I'm sure there were many. We'll ask him about this. But that was a very notable case. Great documentary made out of it. Actually got nominated for an Oscar. And one of the largest private securities settlements, I think, in history. Probably to this day. We'll ask him about that. But he's also an entrepreneur. He's been a CEO of – many enterprises and companies. He's worked with the former president, Gerald Ford's son, Jack Ford. Gosh, what else can I say? Went to Stanford, went to Harvard Law. We'll get into all that. He worked for the governor, Jerry Brown, before in his first terms here many years ago, I guess in the 70s. But his name is Byron Georgiou, and Byron, welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much, Joe, for having me.
It's a real honor to have you here. And I forgot to mention
Richard?
The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. You're one of the commissioners there of only, how many were there, 10 commissioners?
10 commissioners, yeah. Nationwide.
Yeah, so that was pretty, we'll get into all of that. But let's start with your life. You said you're from Detroit, born and raised where? Would you go to high school, and then we'll get into college and write up the... go right down the pipe.
Well, I was born in Henry Ford Hospital. That's about as Detroit as you can get. And raised in Detroit in Dearborn, Michigan. Went to public schools. Graduated from Dearborn High. Came from a Greek Cypriot immigrant family. Mm-hmm. Only child. Spoke Greek only at home until I went to kindergarten. Was lucky enough to get a scholarship, an academic scholarship, to go to Stanford. So I took my first airplane flight in my life and my first time west of Chicago to fly from Detroit to San Francisco to go to Stanford. And
when you were 18?
18.
Wow.
Crew cut kid from the Midwest, wrestler. My life kind of changed. I spent those late 60s years in the Bay Area and... a lot of things changed in my life.
That's where I grew up. It was a lot of fun in the 60s.
It was.
I don't remember very much of it.
So you went to a public high school, and you must have excelled there, because how did you're in Detroit. Who even told you about Stanford?
Well, I would have gone to University of Michigan, where I had been admitted, where the bright kids in Michigan go, or lucky enough to go. And turns out that the head of our high school math department, a wonderful man who's since deceased by the name of Don Marshall, had done some graduate work at Stanford, and I was pretty good at math, and so he encouraged me to apply, and they gave me something called an Alfred P. Sloan Scholarship. Sloan was one of the original CEOs of General Motors, and his foundation give scholarships particularly to kids who are good in the math and sciences, and so they gave me a full ride.
Wow.
Which was, at the time, $2,500 a year. Stanford's tuition was $1,575.
Oh, my gosh.
And room and board was another $1,000, so that was $2,575, and I got $2,500.
Oh, my gosh.
It was pretty good. And I went there. I enjoyed it. Spent a year starting a school up in Northern California, kind of a alternative school that we started on the ranch of my classmates' parents, and that school went on for over almost 30 years. I stayed only a year and went off to law school at Harvard, but a lot of my classmates stayed, and then they got new teachers, and we made...
Was this a grade school you started?
It was a grade school, kindergarten to eighth grade.
So you're a college student starting a grade school.
We had graduated from college. There were nine of us who graduated, couldn't decide whether we were going to graduate school or professional school, and we all decided to go up there. We charged between $0 and $100 a month, depending on ability to pay. We each made $25 a month plus room and board for teaching. So
what, you were teaching math and science? Or?
Well, I taught the older kids, 7th and 8th graders. I taught them pretty much everything.
What was the name of the school?
Mariposa School. It started on the Rancho Mariposa.
Mariposa.
It's not in existence anymore, but it lasted for the better part of 30 years.
Any notable graduates or students that you
remember? I really don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. We had that. But, you know, it was an interesting school because the public schools in Mendocino County were particularly poor. So we ended up with kids who either were way too bright and weren't being challenged in the public schools, or kids who were having real troubles in the public schools. One of the great satisfactions of my life was teaching two 15-year-olds who were still in the eighth grade who didn't know how to read, one Native American student and one basically poor white kid, to read. And we used to meet for an hour before school started, and we read Huckleberry Finn, and we started out sounding out the words.
Wow.
And by about 4 or 5 months into it, they were both reading, and they became insufferable because everywhere we went in a car, they read every single billboard, every single sign. They were so excited to be able to learn how to read.
It reminds me of the story that the black lady in Chicago did the same thing. She started a school. She had kids in, you know, in the early years reading Shakespeare and Dostoevsky. And, I mean, she had to, you know, challenge them. So yeah. Do you know who I'm talking to? You know, is the name song? I'll look it up at the break. But
yeah, I don't know that.
But she was a very well-known educator, and she stuck with it for years. I'll figure it out. I know Ed Asner was in the documentary, and I'll figure it out.
So then I went to Harvard Law School and worked hard and finished there and spent a year clerking for the chief judge of the federal court in San Francisco. And then I spent the next 5 years of my career working with farm workers in the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, which was the first, back in the 30s when they passed the National Labor Relations Act, in order to get it through the Senate, they had to get the votes of the rural senators, they had to exempt farm workers from coverage. So farm workers were not covered under the right to collectively bargain or be free of oppression by their employers. So California passed an act in 1975 that essentially applied the protections of the National Act to farm workers just within California. And they were looking for new lawyers, and I started out in the first batch of lawyers while the rest of my colleagues who went to law school with me were back in New York and Washington with large Wall Street firms making a bundle of dough. I started at $11,000 a year working for the state of California. So
you must have known Cesar Chavez.
I did know Cesar Chavez. Mm. He was a wonderful man. I worked closely with him over a period of years and learned my Spanish out in the fields because I had lots of clients who were monolingual in Spanish, and I had to learn.
Have things improved for farm workers now, or they still have
a
ways to go?
They've improved to some extent as a result of the act, but you know, we really still don't treat the people who pick our food and take care of it as well as we probably ought to. Mm-hmm. When I was there, they still were using something called the short-handled hoe, El Cortito, which was a little short hoe about 18 inches long. And the reason they did it is so that the foreman could stand by the side of the field and see whether the people were working, actually hoeing, because they could see that if they were bent over, they would hoe. And of course, that's led to many people losing their backs and and so forth. But that was not outlawed until about during the Brown administration, about 78 or 80.
Were you working with Mr. Chavez when he went on his hunger strike?
I was not.
You were not?
It was after that.
Okay. Mm.
Anyway, we've got to take a break. Hold it right there. We'll be back with the noted attorney and businessman, Byron Georgiou, on the award-winning It's Your Money and Your Life right after this. Hang on. All right, we're back with It's Your Money and Your Life, the award-winning show with our guest, famed attorney and businessman, Byron Georgiou, and my co-host, Richard Musio, of course. Where do we leave off, gentlemen? I'm kind of forgot.
Well, we left off with farm workers and such.
Farm workers, okay.
Yeah, state of California.
Right. Now, that's after Harvard Law School?
It was.
Okay.
And then what happened is, of course, Jerry Brown was very interested in the implementation of the Farm Labor Act, and so his then legal affairs secretary, a guy by the name of Tony Klein, used to communicate with me all the time to see how things were going. And at some point, the funding was cut off by the farmers in California for the Farm Labor Board. So we were all laid off without pay. And that happened to be at the time Jerry Brown was running for president the first time. So a number of us went to work for Jerry. And
what year was that now?
76.
Okay.
When Jerry won 5 out of 6 primaries, and had he won the last one on the last day in Ohio, he would have denied Jimmy Carter the first-round nomination for the Democratic presidential nomination. But he didn't, and so we went back to work there. But I got to know Jerry. I was his trip director during that campaign, flew around doing, you know, telling him what Medford, Oregon was all about as we were landing there and things of that sort. And so Tony Klein wanted to become a judge, and Jerry wouldn't appoint him until he had a potential successor. So I went to work for Jerry as his deputy legal affairs secretary, and then he appointed Tony as a judge, and I took over. And had a small office of four lawyers, and we did a lot of different things. We had all, handled all the extraditions and clemencies for the governor. The governor appointed, but I recommended 100 judges a year, which is the largest number of judges. The governor of California appoints more judges than anyone else on the planet, more than the president of any nation, more than the governor of any other state, including the United States. We have the largest judiciary in California of any government. And I didn't realize how preposterous it was to have been entrusted with that kind of power at that age, but I did it and enjoyed it. And then after that stint of 4 years, which was the second of Jerry Ground's terms, second of his
four
terms as governor.
No one other governor is ever going to do that in California.
One's ever done it, and no one ever will. He was the youngest governor when he was elected in 1974, elected to the state of California, and the oldest governor now. He's Isn't the oldest serving governor as well. So
there's got to be a documentary about him someday.
Well, you would think so, but... So I worked also in Jerry's 1980 presidential campaign. I was the first brownie, if you will, east of the Mississippi. I ran the Massachusetts and New Hampshire primaries in the 1980 campaign. So I was close to Jerry. I'm still close to Jerry. He stays with me at our home in Las Vegas when he's there. And, I think he's... Kind of grown up into the job at this point. He's become sort of the eminence grise, the old and hardened warrior, and I think he's doing a tremendous job, actually, in California. Was elected by reelected by one of the largest majorities in the history of
pretty fabulous
state.
Career when you think, now that you put it in perspective like this.
Governor, four terms, Mayor of Oakland, two terms. Secretary of State, one term. Attorney General, one term.
Oh my gosh.
Ran unsuccessfully for the Senate. Ran unsuccessfully for the presidency three times. I mean, he's been running for an office or other every 2 years for the part of 40, 50 years, really.
His
father for 40 years before that. So.
Well, he's won more than he lost, which is, Lincoln didn't win anything up until he went and ran for president.
That's correct.
He lost a lot
of elections.
Yeah,
right. I've lost a lot, too, but I don't think I'm running for president at this point, despite the fact that my mother-in-law thinks that I should, but that's nice of her, but I don't think
got one vote.
Gosh, that's got to be quite a thing on the family and everything, right, when you're running for something that big.
Yeah, it's a little hard. So it's interesting. I've had an interesting career. I practiced law here in San Diego County for many years, ran unsuccessfully for the House twice, and then I spent 10 years of counsel to the largest plaintiff securities law firm in the world, Robbins, Geller, Rudman & Dowd, and its predecessor firms. We litigated on behalf of classes of defrauded institutional investors in major cases, Enron, Dynegy, WorldCom, United Health, AOL, Time Warner. And in Enron, we had a team of 30 legal professionals. I was the number two person to Bill Lirak, one of your prior guests
on this program. Guest we ever had on this show.
Mm-hmm. And we spent 8 years litigating that case against all the major banks in the world. Enron was bankrupt. Their auditor, Arthur Andersen, was essentially eviscerated by the litigation. So the only people that were around who could have compensated the defrauded investors in any way were the large banks. And so we sued the banks for essentially conspiring with Enron to defraud Enron's investors.
How about some law firms? Were they defendants also, law firms?
Not really, too many. The law firms were representing the banks. One of the law firms, Paul Weiss, who represented Citibank, who's a notorious defendant in that case and was the first settler for $2 billion. They charged Citibank $10 million a month for 4 years, $500 million in legal fees before they settled with the class of defrauded investors. And we had many, many banks. Enron was an interesting case because the fraud was really enabled by the banks. The Enron you know, claimed to have made a lot of money, but it never made any money. And it was the seventh largest market capitalization company in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they needed money to operate since they were losing money constantly. And the banks essentially hid the money they were providing it so that it wouldn't be reported as loans on Enron's books. They provided $6 billion over the last few years. And we had an email from the vice chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase that said words to the effect that the reason why Enron loved these transactions is they were disguised debt. And the reason that J.P. Morgan Chase loved them is because they were able to charge 300 basis points, 3 percentage points more for the money than they would have been able to charge had they provided regular loans. Of course, that email cost J.P. Morgan Chase $2.2 billion in compensation to the class. We recovered close to $7.5 billion in the case, which was roughly 30% of what the investors lost, which is pretty good, and I think still the largest recovery in the history of securities litigation.
We're going to follow up on Enron right after this. We're going to come back after new sports weather, so hang on. All right, we're back with the award-winning It's Your Money and Your Life, the second half. Now it's time for Richard to thank our sponsors.
Big thank you to our sponsors. Couldn't do it without everybody. UBS, Mr. Michael Karanchin, Drew Freitas, thank you very much. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, the best CFO company here in San Diego. Brenda Geiger and the Geiger Law Group, specializing in asset protection and estate planning. Great time of the year to get your estate planning done around the holidays. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Plato Epic CPAs. I can't say they're in Vista anymore because they just moved to a brand new office. I just saw it on Monday for the first time over in San Marcos, right by the courthouse. Lovely new space, Plato Epic CPAs, now in San Marcos. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Talking about improving the values of businesses, how about Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group, the best business valuation firm here in the country, helping business owners identify the risks that drive the values of their businesses and how to reduce risk and improve value. Our new banking sponsor, California Republic Bank, specializing in working with wealthy families and family offices. VP of that bank, Lane Elliott, is going to be one of our guests in January, coming up here in the new year. And last but not least, Servant Leadership Institute. Check out servantleadershipinstitute.com because on March 9th and 10th in lovely Coronado at the Marriott, they're going to have their fifth annual national conference, and presenting on the same stage at the same time for the first time in history will be Stephen M. R. Covey, Dr. Ken Blanchard, and John Maxwell. So that's a very exciting event coming up here in about 2.5 months. Again, servantleadershipinstitute.com. So big thank you to all of our sponsors. And if you want to know more about our great sponsors, Joe's going to tell us how to do that.
Well, you get over to iymoney.com, go along the top of the page there, you'll see a sponsors tab. Just it's a drop-down menu. Just click on any one or all of them, and their contact information is there and other information about their professions. And they've all been working with Richard for many, many years with great success, right, Richard?
Going on 30 years in some cases, since we were teenagers. Well, not quite that young.
And I think we're going to have Joel Grushkin on in January.
Joel's coming on I think, the 17th.
Always a pleasure to have him because he's so darn smart. So and he saves a lot of money for a lot of
real estate owners.
Large real estate owners, correct?
Absolutely.
So there you go.
So Byron, I spent 2 weeks at Arthur Andersen when I came out of college, and I left there.
Spent 2 weeks or 1 year?
No, 2 weeks because the guy who recruited me, okay, left to join, to start his own firm. So that my third Monday, I was no longer there. I was at the new firm. So that was my year. But that gets us back to Enron. It's probably the shortest day in the history of AA.
Right.
So it was good that I left. AA, 1980. It's not like, I had a premonition or anything. But
we used to call the Arthur Andersen the member of the $1 million a week club because they billed Enron the last year before it collapsed, $52 million in accounting fees.
They're piling up the consulting fees while the audited financial statements were somewhat incomplete.
Right. So on every Monday morning, if you receive $1 million wire from one of your clients, you tend to look a little bit the other way when they do a few shady things.
Yeah. Well, they had to fill up those golden parachutes there, Byron, for gosh sakes. But anyway, getting back to Enron, if that case was happening today, I know there's been some Supreme Court decisions that kind of nullified, the the progress of the settlements. Now,
if you brought that case today, you would essentially recover almost nothing because the Supreme Court, in a case called Stone Ridge, held that even if a third party that conspired with a company that issued securities, and even if the third party knew that the company issuing the securities was going to report their financials falsely in connection with a transaction between the third party and the issuing company, the third party could not be held liable to the defrauded investors unless the third party itself communicated the false financials directly to the investors of the issuer. So the banks would have been completely exonerated from liability. And because Enron went bankrupt and their Arthur Andersen was disappeared, there would have been nobody to pay the investors who lost the better part of $30 billion in the Enron fraud. And you know, I know people think that these are frauds that are just out there and not of consequence. Well, of course, most of the losers are large institutional investors who needed that money to pay the retirement benefits of people who've worked a lifetime.
Well, you guys represented UC UC.
Yeah, the UC Regents
lost
$150 million loss, and they got 30% of it back. But one of our most engaging plaintiffs that we used to use on television when we were promoting the case from time to time was a lineman, a 61-year-old lineman who worked for Portland Electric and spent his career stringing electric wire from the time he was 20 up until then. And in the course of his lifetime, had collected about $500,000 in his 401k plan, which was entirely invested in conservative Portland Electric utility stock so that he could retire on it. But a few months before Enron collapsed, they purchased Portland Electric. So all that stock that was Portland Electric stock got converted into Enron stock and went down to zero. So here was a man who had retired with his wife, had worked a hard life in a physical job out in the elements, who was left with essentially nothing. And one of the great tragedies of our case was that he died before we were able to return the money. His widow got about $150,000 of their $500,000 back, but these are human beings who were defrauded by these 25,000
employees, and think of the families. I mean, right? Just put entire careers down the tubes, and you know, there's another book out there, Retirement Heist by Ellen Schultz, and some big companies like GE, they just stopped paying into their pension plans for in the '80s, and all these pension funds have evaporated.
Well, they have, in the public sector and the private sector. Really, this is a story yet to be told. The most of the pension funds are underfunded, and there'll be a real question when the time comes when all these baby boomers are in the process of retiring, whether there'll be adequate funds available to pay their retirements. And, of course, the trend has been to get rid of these defined benefit plans where people have a guaranteed retirement benefit and instead have defined contribution plans where effectively it's all the responsibility is on the employee to put away enough money and give it to an investment advisor to invest for them and take a lot of fees out of it. And hopefully there'll be enough money when they retire in the fund to pay their retirement benefits. It's a very risky proposition, and I think it has consequences potentially for the society because many of these people will have to sell all their assets to support themselves in their aging years, which could have the impact of depressing our economy.
Yeah, I mean, combined with longer life expectancy.
Right,
it's going to be really interesting how actuarially this plays out.
Yep. And then I guess 10,000 people a day are turning 65 for the next 20 years or so, so we'll know more.
We're going to be at a point where about a quarter of our population is going to be 70 or over.
You know what I found out today? Our national debt, that's like $17 trillion, but they have invaded the Social Security Fund to, I think, about $5 trillion that they're borrowing from other governmental entities now.
It's an intercompany. Intercompany transfer.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Well, it doesn't sound kosher. And then, of course, we're at a record number of foreign investment as far as foreign debt foreign countries holding our debt. It just passed $6 trillion.
We're a subsidiary of China.
Yeah, and Japan.
And Japan.
And Hong Kong. And then a bunch of others. Right. But that's kind of scary. So now there was a PBS special called Bigger Than Enron after, I guess it was had to be after the Enron case, right? Mm-hmm. Or was that... I think it was came out in 2002. Do you remember watching that or seeing anything about that?
I don't recall that, no.
Because they were bringing up all these other situations where, there's some other pending disasters happening in the corporate or Wall Street
world.
Well,
there had been a number of cases. Now, Enron really, there has not been a company that was the seventh largest market capitalization company in the world.
$65 billion
now. Collapse. Mm-hmm. But there are others going on, and, that happens every day. We, in the course of our investigation in the financial crisis, we saw a whole number of companies that were extraordinarily long-living and historical. AIG, American International Group, was one of the earliest insurance companies in the history of America, and they essentially went bankrupt during the financial crisis, were bailed out to the tune of $160 billion. By the U.S. taxpayers. And this is a bank that, an insurance company that was the first one to sell life insurance in Asia, a storied company. And they were engaged in a number of reckless activities and foisted their losses onto the backs of American taxpayers in a preposterous
Whatever happened to John Corzine and that $200 billion that he sat before Congress and they asked him where the money is? And he said, I don't know.
Yeah, that was yet another one. Yeah. He, of course, was a governor of
New Jersey.
And a senator from New Jersey and the head of Goldman Sachs. All the heads of Goldman Sachs seem to find their way into the government when they finish.
So, Byron, you like the topic of corporate governance, don't you?
I do. I've been on the advisory board of the Harvard Law School program on corporate governance for a decade or so. I spend a lot of time. I go back there a couple of times a year to speak on the subject. Corporate governance is important. It is a way to ensure that corporations are governed in ways that are sound and are honest and transparent to their investors and to the general public. It's in the breach, really, these days when you see the trends of corporate governance. We had an astonishing thing happen last week at Citigroup where their lobbyists were essentially wrote the bill. Wrote the provision of the bill that went into the omnibus bill. I mean, these are things that you hardly can believe.
It was plagiarized. If you can get it. I'm just kidding.
It was effectively plagiarized. Right. The legislature took, the Congress took the actual language of the Citigroup lobbyist and put it in to eliminate the modest protections on derivatives trading that were placed into the Dodd-Frank bill to attempt to avoid the consequences yet again of the financial crisis we suffered. During the financial crisis inquiry, we discovered that there were $650 trillion of notional value of derivatives that were traded in a non-transparent way. And these are complicated financial instruments. I won't explain them entirely, but what they effectively do is they're bets on the movement of securities, and when they go the wrong way, nobody pays.
Yeah.
And that's what in part led to our collapse.
Well, we're going to get more into the FCIC and these other concepts. We'll come right back after this break, so hang on. All right, we're back in the home stretch with Byron Georgiou, noted attorney and businessman here in San Diego, Nevada, and all over the world, maybe. Anyway, welcome back, Byron. Derivatives and Dodd-Frank and all these recent developments in the FCIC, should we be more or less optimistic about the future with the current situation globally and domestically?
I think that we still haven't seen the end of the consequences of the financial crisis. People don't realize. I mean, my wife and I moved to Nevada 9 years ago. We have still the highest unemployment rate in the nation, the highest rate of home foreclosures, the highest number of bankruptcies, the highest rate of underwater mortgages. Almost 70% of the people in Clark County owe more on their homes than in their mortgages than the homes are worth. So this is a consequence all over the nation in many, many pockets. Although we have the wealthiest of our citizens are doing extraordinarily well, most of the people in the society are still dramatically impacted by the consequences of the financial crisis. We have had very little income improvement for the rank and file working person or middle class people, and that's in part a consequence of that crisis.
You wanted to mention something about robber barons then and now. Did you?
Well, I mean, that's just a little story. When I was at Stanford, they used to call the team's name was the Stanford Indians, and for that year,
Jim Plunkett,
right. And the first that was the year I went was the first year that any Native American had ever been admitted to the school. So they obviously petitioned to have this Chief Potawatomi, who was a football player dressed up as an Indian, who used to in a headdress and perform every time there was a touchdown, to get rid of him. So they allowed the students to have a plebiscite as to what the new name of the university mascot should be, and some of us organized a drive, and we got the 96% of the students to vote to rename it the Stanford Robber Barons in honor of our founder. But the board of trustees nixed that, and so that's
why.
How we ended up with the Stanford Cardinal and the Stanford Tree, which were the second and third choices of the students.
Interesting choice of mascot,
Northwestern students didn't get to name their team the Purple Haze either,
but it's interesting. I mean, we shouldn't really ignore the consequence of these developments, because back in the Gilded Age, when the robber barons essentially admitted to owning the government and got their way with everything in Congress and in the administrations— this display last week of arrogance on this omnibus bill, where effectively the people who put in a half $1 billion of money into this election last cycle are the robber barons of the modern age, who have tremendous control, disproportionate control over the government. And Wall Street, regrettably, continues to reign and doesn't want to have any regulation of any sort. You know, capitalism is I'm a confirmed capitalist. I'm in a lot of businesses. I believe that when you have a good idea and you invest money and you do well, you're entitled to reap all the rewards of that. But when you invest and it turns out not so well, then you have the right and the obligation to go bankrupt and distribute your assets among your creditors and go to the next thing. But somehow Wall Street feels that the United States taxpayers should be the ones to bail them out when things go bad for them, and that they should get all the benefits, they should reap all the rewards when it's a success, and they should put the burden of their losses on the taxpayers. I think that's profoundly unfair.
Yeah, and it didn't stop with TARP. I mean, these quantitative easing, I mean, they're just pumping out billions of dollars every month.
People don't realize the other thing is the permission of the banks to borrow at the federal discount window at 25 or 50 basis points and then lend the money back effectively to the federal taxpayers by purchasing treasury securities that pay 2.5 percentage points. So you're effectively recapitalizing the banks at the expense of the federal taxpayers every day. Mm-hmm. And this is a story that's not well known, and people are outraged by it. And it's one of the great things that unites conservatives and liberals in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, David Vitter, who's a conservative Republican senator from Louisiana, and Sherrod Brown, who's a very liberal Democratic senator from Ohio, jointly sponsored a bill to prevent exactly these practices. So this is, I think, one of the positive trends I think you can see is that—
Did the bill pass or don't we know?
It did not pass yet. No. But the conservatives and the liberals are working together on attempting to limit these kinds of
decisions. So, Byron, speaking of businesses, you are the controlling shareholder of a really neat company called Extreme Green Electric Vehicles. Tell us about that, please.
It's a company. We manufacture vehicles in Las Vegas. We manufacture all-electric, lithium-ion, iron phosphate, battery-powered vehicles for the working space. We replace things like John Deere Gators and Kawasaki Mules and Kubotas and Polarises that are highly polluting vehicles, and we use them for
law enforcement,
mining, law enforcement, security, farming. And it's interesting. They're all American-made, and we are very excited. We're exporting them around the world. We're one of the few companies in Nevada that manufactures in Nevada and exports to Mexico. We've
wow.
sold quite a lot
How about
of vehicles
that?
In Mexico City and Guadalajara.
Let's give the website xgev.com for extreme green electric vehicles, XGEV. So check that out. What else are you involved in these days, Byron?
Well, I'm a member of the board of directors and the largest shareholder of a company called Health Fusion, which is based here in Solana Beach, which is an electronic health records company. I'm still a partner with Jack Ford, President Ford's son, in a company called InfoPlace USA that's headquartered here in Oceanside, California. And
nice.
I'm involved in a few different activities.
And still involved
activities.
Your alma mater, still involved there?
I am. I do. I'm on the, you know, I'm involved at Stanford. I'm involved at Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. I do some other business ventures of various sorts. We tried Mortgage Resolution Partners was an attempt to deal with the underwater mortgage crisis in America. Not overly successful. We had... North Las Vegas, which had the highest number of
foreclosures
in the country on a per capita basis, the city council had $1.5 million spent by Wall Street in their city to prevent them from adopting our proposed solution, which was to have the city essentially purchase these underwater mortgages and refinance them into mortgages that were affordable and were maybe slightly less than the value of the current.
Maybe even lease back. Byron, it's been a real honor and privilege to have you on our show tonight. We'll have to have you back sometime. And thank you to Dr. Therese Collins, who also showed up, your wife. She's here. And Richard, always great seeing you. And Eric Rubalcava.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Of course.
Just a season.
Yes. Eric Rubalcava, great seeing you, our sound engineer. Thanks to Craig Blanky, our account executive, and to Dave Sniff, our programming genius. Happy holidays, everybody.
And thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. And all the podcasts are on iymoney.com. Of course, you'll get to hear this one and several others. So good night now. See you next week. Bye-bye.